Millions of people have lost weight with personalized plans from Noom, like Evan, who can't stand salads and still lost 50 pounds.
Salads generally for most people are the easy button, right? For me, that wasn't an option. I never really was a salad guy. That's just not who I am. But Noom worked for me.
Get your personalized plan today at Noom.com. Real Noom user compensated to provide their story. In 4 weeks, the typical Noom user can expect to lose 1 to 2 pounds per week. Individual results may vary.
With LinkedIn Jobs, we tap into a network of more than a billion professionals to help you find quality professionals quickly and easily for any role you need. Marketing wizards? Found them.
Software engineers?
Found.
That project manager I could never seem to hire?
And found. LinkedIn Jobs quickly matches your roles with candidates with the right skills and experience. In fact, 86% of small businesses get a qualified candidate within 24 hours. Post your first job for free and get started at linkedin.com/spoken. That's linkedin.com/spoken. Terms and conditions apply.
Hello and welcome to another Curzon Film Podcast. This week, we open up the pod bay doors to Damien Chazelle's Neil Armstrong biopic, First Man. Sitting in Mission Control, you've got me, Jake Cunningham. And in the lunar podule, we've also got Commander Kelly Powell.
Hello.
Captain Sam Howlett.
Morning.
And a special guest too, after Dave Corkery was the second man from the Wire Strip podcast with Kobe and Dave, Kobe Omenaka's here as well.
Thank you very much. I don't get like a ranking, like Commander and Lieutenant. What am I?
Oh, Commander, Captain, what's better than those? I mean, it's definitely better than you two.
Yeah.
Admiral? Is that a thing?
I'll take Admiral.
Yeah, that's a good one.
That's fine.
Admiral's naval. You wouldn't be. Space Navy.
It's a ship, though.
Space Navy, yeah.
If Trump gets his way, that's going to happen. All right. Sincere apologies for that intro, everyone.
That's right. The best one. Yeah, well done. You brought it back.
Thanks. So, yes, we're talking about First Man. This week, sadly, we've got no one to talk to about it other than ourselves, but really that's the best company we could ask for. It's directed by Damien Chazelle, who infamously didn't win Best Picture for his film La La Land, but did win Best Director. And that's not the only film he's made. He made Guy and Madeline on a Park Bench. That was his mumblecore black and white musical. Then he made a little film called Whiplash, then La La Land, and here we are with First Man, and that's all in the space of 9 years. Kobe, can I ask you, how are you feeling about Damien Chazelle?
Excited.
Yeah?
Generally. And if someone said to me after La La Land, after Whiplash, that he's going to be making a film set in space, I would have not believed you at all. And I'm surprised there's no jazz in this. But he's phenomenal talent, and I'm just excited about him and Justin Hurwitz as well. Those two as a combination, I think, are fantastic. And yeah,
both 33 years old.
Yeah, it's crazy.
I think I might be the oldest in this room. I'm like 38, and anyone who's younger than me making excellent films and excellent stuff, I'm just insanely,
making four of them.
Insanely jealous. Yeah.
Yeah, but he didn't make Citizen Kane when he was 23, so really he's just a chump.
What a slacker.
Yeah.
Lazy
Chazelle.
Get it together. Right, so this is First Man. On the heels of their six-time Academy Award-winning smash La La Land, Oscar-winning director Damien Chazelle and star Ryan Gosling re-team. It's for the riveting story of NASA's mission to land a man on the moon, focusing on Neil Armstrong from the years of 61 to 69, a visceral first-person account based on the book by James R. Hansen. The film explores the sacrifices and the cost on Armstrong and on the nation of one of the most dangerous missions in history. We mentioned already, Damien's just coming off of the back of La La Land. Mm. This had already begun development. What were your first thoughts when this got announced, Sam?
I thought it was a really good choice, actually, because felt like I was one of La La Land's biggest defenders, because I felt that became a film.
Went through the whole horrible
after a few months, that became a film. After it was like released at film festivals and everyone loved it, that suddenly became a film that people had to defend. Mm. And I was one of the people that defended it. I think it's a really great film, and I think that when this was announced that he was re-teaming with Ryan Gosling, I thought it was a really great choice from all fronts, and I think it's absolutely lived up to that. Yeah. Especially coming off La La Land, coming off the Oscar wing. And coming off all the weird controversy around that Oscar win, I think, to get right back into making a film and making such a confident film as well.
So it's important for him to just quickly roll into something else to, rather than get pinned down as he's the guy that does the music films.
He's the guy that lost to Moonlight.
Do you think that will hold him back, though, ever? I didn't think that was really an issue.
No, I don't. I think it's just for a while that's kind of what he was...
That was the narrative.
That was sort of the narrative. It was a weird Oscar campaign, and it was a weird time for Damien Chazelle, I think. Looking back now, he's still the youngest person to win a Best Director award. He's still made 4 films in 9 years at the age of 33. Yeah. And this is, I think, perhaps his best film.
I think outside of the Oscar thing, I think he was perhaps in danger of being typecast as a jazz musically based kind of film director. Yeah. And that's what completely sideswiped me with this film. So whether he's won the Oscar or not for La La Land, I think it's great that he's taken a step in a completely different direction.
You get the sense that he really is just starting his career, you know? And he's such a confident filmmaker. I feel like it's not really... I think in the next sort of decade, it won't be the thing that we know him by, you know?
Yeah. I mean, it'd almost be nice to see him have a swing and a miss at something, just to make sure, like,
so we know he's
real.
Human.
He is human. Yeah, exactly. Yeah. He does bleed.
Yeah. Right. So something that I find really interesting thinking about La La Land and thinking about this film is that, in a way, First Man feels like a smaller film in terms of scale. Yeah. It got me thinking about the story that it's trying to tell. And for me, I'm a big, enormous space nerd. And I think landing on the moon is pretty much the biggest news that's ever happened.
Yeah.
And he approaches a story that is so iconic and enormous with a much smaller scale. So let's explore that route that Chazelle takes. Is it surface level or is it a bit meatier?
Oh my god, that's gonna be happening the whole time, isn't it? Okay, well, I'll answer that seriously.
Please, someone else answer that one.
It's funny, I was thinking the same thing, you know. Well, this film isn't smaller on the scale of like technical ability. Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's probably the most technically difficult film he's made to date, but it was an intimate film in many ways, you know, in the way that it's shot. The music, the storyline, the subjectivity. And I think that he's done such a good job of making us believe, you know, Ryan Gosling is Neil Armstrong. I kind of forgot. As big a star as Ryan Gosling is, I was in it. I was totally... Yeah. He did... Ryan Gosling was great in this, I think, as well. Mm. His performance was super understated and subtle and restrained. And you know, we kind of forget with his stardom nowadays is that he's actually a bloody good actor. You know, I just really enjoyed the way that he made us feel that we were...
It's a very internalised performance.
Very internalised, yeah, exactly.
But I think that's a lot of the film. It's a whole lot of men who don't really know how to communicate, who are then confronted with, like, unimaginable awe and wonder, and they just can't process it, really. But so let's delve into the Neil Armstrong as a character, because I think we so often think of Neil Armstrong as the person on... or the guy on the moon, but not really a person.
Yeah. Mm-hmm.
And I think this is what the film is trying to get into. So to set it up, Neil Armstrong, he's testing jets and then is selected to become part of the team that would become Apollo. It's not just Neil Armstrong that we see there. So we've got Claire Foy as Janet Sheeran, who's Neil Armstrong's first wife. And then in NASA, you've got Jason Clarke as Ed White. So he was one of the original Mercury 7. So those are the 7 guys who first went into space, not to the moon. Mm-hmm. Kyle Chandler as Deke Slayton, another member of the original Mercury 7. Corey Stoll as Buzz Aldrin, so the second man on the moon. Christopher Abbott as David Scott. He's another member of the Gemini team. Mm, yeah. Not the Gemini team.
He gets recruited as part of the Gemini team.
And so there's a lot of these teams and terminologies and eras that we float through. We kind of travel with Neil. He's our guide through this.
And is it set about 8 years?
Yeah,
film?
So, that was 61 to 69.
Right.
So that's how long he was in NASA. That's basically from... I listened to something this morning, and Chazelle was saying that they bookended the movie according to when he gone into NASA and then when they landed.
And
so we do follow Neil, but I think it's important to have that it's not an ensemble film, but it feels like there's quite a strong supporting cast.
Absolutely.
And I think that's down to Josh Singer, the writer.
Yeah.
His two previous credits, or biggest credits, would be The Post, co-written with Liz Hanna, and Spotlight, which again, I think, are very process-driven ensemble films. And they're quite mechanical in a way.
But also very humanist as well.
Yeah.
They are about big things, but looking at the smaller people within the big thing.
Yeah.
And this, I think this film does that a lot with, like, there's so many like close-ups and not many wide shots, which is weird for a space film.
Yeah.
They sort of reserve the big Earth shots, you know, when they really get into that towards later in the film, because I think a lot of the film, you feel trapped with Neil. On Earth and when he's in the shuttles.
Well, it does give you that kind of impact as well, you know.
Yeah.
When it does finally open up, you kind of, you have that release that this, in the same way that the characters are going through.
And that ties in with the music as well, with Damien Chazelle. Because one of my outstanding parts, shots and scenes in the film was when it just goes to silence. And I'm not going to explain to people what happens at that point, but it's just like, it suddenly becomes silent and you're like, whoa. And that for me is like, still, I've got goosebumps thinking about that. But coming up to that point, like you said, there's a personal story. It starts off with a personal tragedy, which follows Neil and family through that. And for a space film, it is, you're inside, I don't know what how big it is, these kind of capsules that they're in, but it's tiny. It's super tiny. But at the same time, it's on a big screen. And that kind of juxtaposition is phenomenal, how they put it together and how we shot it. Is mind-blowing,
to be honest with you. And it opens with one of those. Like, we're with Neil in one of the jets as well. And from that very first scene, you get a sense of how much we are going to be propelled through this story.
Yeah.
You cannot escape it.
Yeah, no. And everything, so the DP, Linus Sandgren, the production designer, Nathan Crowley, and the sound designer, Eiling Lee, they all work together to make everything seem really old. And really rickety, and everything's kind of creaking.
Yes,
and like every time something was, and there's a joke when someone's like, "Oh, has anyone got a Swiss Army knife? A Swiss Army knife?"
Yeah.
So everything feels like homemade and really unsafe. And because I think when you think of the space program, you think of the most high tech technology, and everyone's super safe, and everything's
they're making us go along.
Everything looks like I'm not getting in that at all. Yeah. I'm not getting anywhere near that thing.
Watching this, and this is the thing about biopics is that now I want to see a full-blown documentary about this, and I want to understand this, but it's given me that insight which I never had, because before this, Neil Armstrong was this fully formed figure who was just just appeared on the moon. But now you're like, why on earth would you want to go to the moon? That's actually insane.
You realize you all feel what they were feeling, which is like, you know, getting into this like welded, handmade spacecraft that's going to lead you through space. Like, that's insane. That's really insane.
Oh, it's cool, though.
It's so cool. I love it so much.
But the biggest, I mean, Gravity came out a few years ago, which I loved. I haven't seen it since on a small screen, and I don't think I will. Apollo 13. Those just don't have the same kind of feeling for me as this portrayed. And
I don't think they're as personal as this.
And I think that's part of the thing, isn't it? Because even though there is this expanse, there's science, there's the space, that personal aspect, both in how it's shot and the story, I think is the thing that really is like drives us forward in such a way we can't even... if you said this is a space film, that's underselling it massively.
Yeah. Oh, yeah.
So, yeah, I think you mentioned it already, the flight scenes and the grounded scenes, I think they are very different. When they are up in the plane, because of that sound design and that production design, to me, those felt like there's not just shaky because of it's a Paul Greengrass trying to give you some edgy drama. It felt like this is properly the wrestling between man and machine. And this is like trying to force ourselves on nature is what's happening there. And that's what's that resistance we're getting back. And it's like a breath of fresh air when they finally drop down to Earth. And it's in a weird kind of slightly fisheye Terrence Malick flow to it, the camera there. It's very different.
Well, I think it's so different from how Whiplash and La La Land look, which is why I think this is a really great sort of progression of someone's directorial voice. And I think even from the first trailer, it was very clear that this film's going to look really old. It's going to be very grainy. We think he shot
on some kind of film.
Yeah.
I guess.
I think, and that's a really, you know, he's made a choice there to make the film look like that. And he confidently sticks with it all the way through. Because I think this film could very, this kind of film could have very easily been like, and no disrespect to this film, could have been like Hidden Figures, which is a film I really enjoy, but it's a very safe film. Everything's in focus, everything looks normal, everything, you know, it's very well acted, but it's very sort of solid, everything ticks along just as you expect it to. And I think in 1995 or something, Hidden Figures would have won Best Picture. But because film has changed and the way audiences react to film change and the way the Oscars react to films have changed, it's interesting that the space film's now the Oscar favourite, more one of the Oscar favourites, is this film that looks like this in such a different and interesting and creative way.
He shot it like a, I mean, I think he kind of saw it in his mind's eye as like a he was making a documentary almost. You know, he said that like he wanted that feel of like he wanted to treat it like documentarians would treat
I imagine
subject, you know?
There was a lot of watching For All Mankind,
the
80s documentary with the Brian Eno music, and a lot of that is just building an atmosphere of what the space station, or sorry, the research facilities were like, and just trying to build that world. And I think he does a great way of, he does that really well. And something that in the book, The Right Stuff, the film, which I have not seen yet because I'm waiting to see it on the big screen, something that I get into is the monotony and the routine that men get into. That there was so much testing, like that a medical test could last 4 hours, and they just had to sit there and then come out and then do it again, and that was a day's work. And you do get a sense of the frustration that the men have as well, that these have come, they're just after the war, they're jet pilots, they're so used to constant progression and movement, and they're given this opportunity to, you can go further than anyone's gone before. But before that, you've got to sit down and play ball and deal with
and
the mess of the politics.
Bureaucracy.
And you've suddenly got to learn about PR and how to present yourself. And Neil is really nicely contrasted to Corey Stoll's Buzz Aldrin in that
The villain, of the film.
Strange one. But Buzz really knows how to sell the mission.
Buzz Aldrin, he's presented as like kind of loud mouth. Always
nobody
says
really
what he thinks.
Nobody
really likes him, but he's really good at like talking to the journalists and at the press conferences. He's kind of, he's the guy you hate at school. And Buzz
Aldrin, everyone else thinks is funny, but you don't.
But Neil Armstrong's like, I don't get why people like this guy. Like, I'm really clever. I'm really nice. Why don't you just like me?
I don't know if Neil would be that cynical.
I don't think he cares though. That's the thing. He's not the. Yeah, he's not that. He's just like, I'm just here to go to the moon.
The mission's the mission.
I don't care what people think of it.
There were some scenes where it was clear that he was so preoccupied by. He was given this mission, and this is what he had to do. And then everything became super tunnel vision towards that, to the detriment of his personal surroundings around him, and. Yeah, and the antithesis is Buzz Aldrin. I don't know if that's his real character, but I'm sure there might be some puff piece in BuzzFeed later on saying, I'm not like this.
Yeah,
I'm like a really nice guy, honestly.
Well, I think that's a nice lead into the rest of the supporting cast. I think Corey Stoll, I like Corey Stoll a lot.
Do you think he stole the show?
Hey,
good. Oh, good Lord.
Good. No, he didn't.
No.
This Mother's Day, celebrate the extraordinary women in your life with a heartfelt gift from Blue Nile. Whether it's for your mom, a mother figure, or yourself as a mom, find that perfect piece to express your love and appreciation. Explore Blue Nile's exquisite pearls and mesmerizing gemstones that she's sure to love. Enjoy fast shipping options like guaranteed free shipping and returns. Make this Mother's Day unforgettable with a piece from Blue Nile. Right now, get up to 50% off at BlueNile.com. That's BlueNile.com.
Even when we're on a budget, we still deserve nice things. Quince is a place to scoop up stunning high-end goods for 50 to 80% less than similar brands. They have buttery soft cashmere sweaters starting at $50, luxurious Italian leather bags, and so much more. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe, ethical, and responsible manufacturing. Get the high-end goods you'll love without the high price tag with Quince. Go to Quince.com/style for free shipping and 365-day returns.
No, really, in the supporting cast, there's no crater than Kyle Chandler.
Oh my god!
What?
they just came up to you, didn't they? Just,
yeah.
You've not written these down at all, have you?
Okay. Kyle Chandler, if you like.
Yeah, I love Kyle Chandler. Yeah. I think I can't think of a film where he's a lead.
No.
He's an incredible supporting cast all the time.
For me, he's always like, he's that guy.
He is that guy.
He needs his like sideways, like Paul Giamatti, so he can step out behind the shadows a bit more.
Yeah, yeah. Mm. I'm sure he'll get it one day. Yeah. But he's great in this. He's great in Manchester by the Sea. Mm.
Yeah.
He's the lead in Friday Night Lights. That's his...
That's TV.
Yeah.
That's not as good as film,
famously.
Stupid old TV.
So he doesn't really get into this too much in the film, but I think you can see it in the performance. So Kyle Chandler plays a guy called Deke Slayton, who I think is a really fascinating guy. So the Mercury 7, the first seven guys to actually go into space. So you had a bit of an overlap with the Gemini team, and Deke was the only one who didn't make it into space.
Right.
So he had a bit of a heart, what's it called when it...
A heart murmur? Irregular heartbeat?
Yeah. Irregular heart stuff. And so the six guys went up, and then he had his medical thing, and he said, we can't risk it.
Mm.
And so they made him the captain of astronauts, basically. but you're staying on the ground.
That sounds like a five-year-old would make up. Yeah. Like, what do you want to be when you're older? I want to be the captain of astronauts.
Yeah. chief of NASA astronaut office.
Oh, right, that's cool.
But I think in that performance, you can see that he's got so much pride and admiration for the guys, but always underlining that is his feeling that
he never
could
got to
have
go.
Been me.
I didn't know that was the case. Yeah. So yeah, I can see that now. I replay his performance in there definitely.
And he's got so much love for the man. Mm.
He really believes in the
mission. Yeah, he does.
Yeah.
I think there will be a Deke Slayton film down the line.
Yeah.
Maybe that can be the Kyle Chandler lead film.
Spin-off.
Yeah. Yeah.
I'll be up for that.
But I think the biggest supporting role, the one that's got a lot more coverage, even as much as Gosling himself, is Claire Foy.
Yeah.
And she's terrific in this. Over the last year, we've seen her come out of The Crown, do Unsane, that's her lead for the first time in a film. Take This, and then we've got A Girl with a Dragon Tattoo in a couple of months as well.
Not forgetting Breathe as well.
Yeah, Breathe.
But she was the supporting role in this, very much so. Obviously, a very difficult task. It's not just a standard family film. Mm. But I'm looking forward to definitely seeing like what happens with A Girl with a Dragon Tattoo film, where she is like the out and out star of that piece.
Yeah. Mm. Star of a big film.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Mm.
Oh, and I think in this she gets... she gets a tough task. Mm-hmm. The doting wife is always a tough one for any actress to do and really come out of it the other side and being really impressed with that. It's hard to be
memorable as that character because that's it's probably the most portrayed character in film, that kind of the doting wife, the kind of that often feels shoehorned in. And I think she does something really interesting with it.
Yeah, I don't think she's just that.
Yeah,
I don't think it's
not
fair
to
just label her that. I think she holds so much weight in this film, actually. Mm. And she does such a great job because she is the only female sort of voice in this film. Mm. And I think she does such an excellent job of playing... You know, there's obviously the element of the supporting wife, but, she is sort of in command of the domestic space in the way that, like, you know, he kind of lets her down in many ways in that space. And I think you feel that. You feel that tension. You get a different side to Neil. I think the reflection of, who he is in that space is based on her performance,
I mean, some of my favourite shots were just of her in the house, like walking down the corridor.
Yeah, she holds
standing in the room.
She's got such a presence.
Yeah.
Yeah.
And I always undercutting her performances, I think this anger and frustration with a man who just won't talk.
Yeah.
Who won't communicate. Us men. Yeah.
Yeah. I mean, she says at one point, like, she just wanted a normal life. She wanted to marry someone and have children. And she got the antithesis of that.
I think after the war, kind of a military life was, arguably something that, people would have aspired to and would have felt as being a comfortable thing.
Yeah.
And then suddenly, that she has gone into that relationship thinking maybe that's what's going to happen. And then the fact that your husband then might turn to you and say, actually, going on the moon.
Yeah.
Mm. See that thing over there? Yeah, I'm going over there.
Mm.
Might not come back, but...
Yeah, and there's also, we haven't really touched upon it, but there is a tragic event in their past that I think really...
I mean, that starts the film.
Yeah, mm. we can tell what it is, can't we? Yeah, so their daughter dies of a brain tumour, and that really shapes Neil more than any other event in the film.
Yeah. It's the thing that propels him the most.
Yeah, and it's not something that's just forgotten about. It's almost, you can feel, it feels like he's thinking of that in every single shot.
Mm.
And it's always in the back of his eyes. And the way he was obsessively focused about trying to save her in the beginning is then mirrored of how obsessively he's trying to solve another another mission.
The energy's transferred.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah. Mm. Yeah.
Something that was a really nice surprise for me with this film was how quickly it went. I'm frustratingly, for my sins, very aware of how long things are in cinema. I find it tough to just kind of settle down a bit. Mm-hmm. And there are two films in the last year where I've come out of thinking, God, that was short. Or like a lot shorter than I thought.
Yeah.
And interestingly, both Gosling films, Blade Runner 2049 and First Man. We were in the same screening, came out of that thinking that felt like
an hour
45.
Yeah.
It's a bit of an epic.
2.5 hours,
And maybe that's down to what we began the conversation with about this personal aspect of it, that something that is presenting itself as a Oscar-worthy space film that's 2.5 hours long. You think of it having this massive scope. And that kind of fooled me into thinking it had this hour 50 runtime. But I think that's down to the pace of it, that it's got a great, fantastic rhythm. And you're constantly being moved by it.
Very thrilling.
Oh, completely.
I mean, even though you know what's going to happen, if you know the history,
it's probably the one thing that every single person on the planet knows what happens.
Yeah, it's not a spoiler cast.
Yeah, exactly.
But that's one of the things that would perhaps have stopped me watching this. Is that we know what happens. He gets on there, so
that's the end of it.
He got to that film set.
It's weird they didn't cast anyone as Stanley Kubrick, isn't it? Yeah. I think one of the reasons it felt it made you sort of not forget what happens, but not care that you know what happens, is things like the Gemini 8 sequence, which I had no idea what the hell that was about, and it's when he goes in there with. The guy that Christopher Abbott plays.
Oh, yeah. Christopher Abbott and David Scott.
Yeah, so when they go up and it cuts back to Claire Foy's character who's listening on the radio.
Yes.
And it cuts back and forth quite a lot, and it seems to be going well and it doesn't go well. And then that feels like, I don't know how long that sequence lasts for. It could be, in my head, it's anywhere between like 10 minutes and an hour. But it's so intense and so cinematic.
And it's really bold that is almost the centerpiece of the film.
Yeah.
A film about landing on the moon.
Yeah.
The moon landing is really, in a way, downplayed compared
to that. It's very quiet, the moon landing, isn't it? It's very quiet and very sort of serene and peaceful. And like the music's the music's more down to earth, whereas here it's like...
Well, I think because the moon landing is almost the closure, in many ways, as you'll see. But... that is the action sequence of the film. I think that maybe that's why it took centerfold.
And what's great is when it gets up there, it doesn't kind of rest on its laurels.
No.
It knows when the film is finished.
Yeah.
Yeah.
The ending of this film is bizarre. But in a really nice way. It's just quiet.
Yeah.
And like it's such a full stop.
Well, I think it's indicative of what he was trying to do with it, you know.
Yeah, but I really like it.
Thinking about it, Damien Chazelle, like he's actually played quite a bit with how to end something.
Oh yeah.
Whiplash and La La Land, I think Whiplash is a very abrupt ending, but it's set up for 10 minutes
An abrupt ending. Yeah. Yeah.
And La La Land, you've got that whole dream sequence bit that's a good 10 minutes. And then this is some hybrid version of the two. I think there's something about him that he knows.
Yeah,
he knows how to end the film properly.
Yeah.
And that's the thing. That often leads a discussion after a film is like how it ends. And if you start with that, then that often sets how you recommend it to other people.
Yeah.
It was a mute, very very muted and understated ending. Mm. And I hadn't thought about what they'd have to do when people come back from space, of course. You don't know what's going on in there.
Narrative, I just appreciated it so much that this film is almost taking place on two levels all the time, and he's doing such a great job of intercutting those two stories, you know, the Neil Armstrong, the family man, versus Neil Armstrong, the astronaut. And I feel like that ending, it's just tied up so his whole arc is tied up so nicely that he found his way back to her, you know, almost like in the way that the astronauts found their way back to Earth, you know. It's just so...
They come back, but they're never the same. I think we might have to wrap it up there. So, Gosling, he's certainly first class and not Ryanair.
Oh, that's a good one.
Yeah.
I like that one.
You're happy with that.
Yeah. All right. But it's First Man is not the only film out this week. If you do want to stay in and watch something on demand, you can do. There's a film out this coming Monday on Curzon Home Cinema called The Happy Prince. It's directed by Rupert Everett. And Kelly, you met the man to talk about it, didn't you?
Yeah, I did.
Ages ago.
Yeah, but it was a great interview. He was quite illuminating. Yeah, he was fun.
So that's out on Monday. And if you want to listen to that interview in a weird double bill, it's part of our Hereditary episode. So that's our 16th of June episode. So head back and listen to that if you want to. And if you've got any thoughts on First Man or any other recent releases, do let us know. You can email us at podcast@curzon.com. We'll read those out on next week's show, or you can tweet us at Curzon Cinemas. And if you've enjoyed this show and you'd want to hear more, you can subscribe. You can do that on iTunes or Acast or wherever you might get your pods. Leave us a review or a comment as well. Next week we're going to be talking about Dog Man. What's that one, Sam?
Dog Man is a Mateo Garona's latest pseudo gangster flick. Very exciting. Mm-hmm. We have an interview with Mateo Garona.
This is the chap that directed Tale of Tales.
The Tale of Tales and Gomorrah.
Yeah.
So very excited about that one.
The film version of Gomorrah.
He did the film version, okay. Yeah.
Yeah, I'm excited to get that one.
Which has a moment in it that I've never forgotten about.
Well, won't watch it.
He's notoriously violent, isn't he?
Yeah. This is very much him going back to how he made his name.
Yeah,
so I kind of expected after Tale of Tales that he might go further.
He did this weird fantasy anthology film and come back to Italian gangsters.
All right. So that's about it. If you want to keep in touch with all the gang around the table, you can follow Kelly at @KS_pal. Mm-hmm. Sam, you are at @SamHowlett_1.
I am.
Kobe, you are at Kobe Star with two R's.
Cobe Star with two R's at the end.
Yes. And you can follow me at Jake H. Cunningham. But we're not the only podcast out there. Kobe, tell us about yours.
So yeah, I've got two pop culture podcasts. One being Flicks Watcher, where we get other podcasters on. Jake is due to come on. And when I first met Kelly a few weeks ago, we said, you need to come on the podcast. So please do come on. Invite other podcasters on, and they pick the films from Netflix, and we talk about them and then rate them using our random scoring system. And also The Wire Stripped, where myself and Dave Corkery, formerly of this podcast, The Incredibles 2 episode, I believe.
Yeah, it was, yeah.
We go through each episode of The Wire one by one, and includes interviews from cast and fans and experts and stuff like that.
And you recently had Clark Peters on, who he joined our Three Billboards.
He did.
He is so cool.
He's the best person in the entire world, honestly. I love him.
I do love that interview. The man just speaks in proverbs. All right, that's about it. Goodbye from Kelly.
Bye-bye.
Bye-bye from Sam.
Goodbye.
Bye from Kobe.
Bye.
Bye from me. Bye-bye.
Planning for your next trip?
Elevate your travel style with Quince.
Quince has all the jet-setting essentials you'll want for your next getaway, like European linen, premium luggage options, buttery soft Italian leather bags, and so much more. And it's all priced at 50 to 80% less than similar brands. Plus, Quince only works with factories that use safe and ethical manufacturing practices. Pack your bags with high-quality essentials you'll be wearing for vacations to come with Quince. Go to quince.com/pack for free shipping and 365-day returns.
Hey, everyone. Craig Robinson here. I want you to check out the Ways to Win podcast, brought to you by Ford and the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. On Ways to Win, Coach Cal and I will discuss leadership lessons we've learned. We know all about the days spent perfecting your craft outside of the limelight, and have knowledge to share about how strength, inspiration, encouragement, and adaptability are the key ingredients to drive toward your dreams. And those same ingredients can be found in the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. So check out my podcast, Ways to Win, and also check out the new 2024 Ford F-150 truck. Learn more at Ford.com. Built Ford Tough, Built Ford Proud.